Good evening. This is Russ Werner, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and tonight's host of Sports Today, the one-hour-long show that airs every Tuesday and Thursday evening from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. 25. We are going to start off tonight with some NBA basketball action from the NBA playoffs. Thunder run away from Nuggets in Game 7. Thunder 125, Nuggets 93. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander scored 35 points to lead the Oklahoma City Thunder to a 125-93 home win over the Denver Nuggets in Game 7 of their Western Conference second-round series on Sunday. The Thunder advanced to the Western Conference Finals for the first time since 2016. Oklahoma City opens the Conference Finals against Minnesota Timberwolves at home on Tuesday. After scoring just 6 points in Thursday's loss, Thunder All-Star Jalen Williams bounced back in a big way, pouring in 24 points on 10 of 17 shooting. Gilgeous-Alexander was 12 of 19 from the floor with 3 steals and no turnovers. "He, Williams, was amazing," said Gilgeous-Alexander. "He wouldn't have played the way he played today last year. I know that 100%. To see him take that step forward is a really proud moment." Early on, it looked like the Nuggets were carrying over the momentum from their Game 6 win. Denver led by double digits with a minute left in the first quarter before the Thunder ripped off a 13-0 run spanning the first and second quarters to take the lead for the first time. The Thunder grabbed the lead for good on Lugwens Dort's three-pointer with 7:20 left in the first half. Oklahoma City closed the first half on an 18-5 run, including back-to-back Denver turnovers that led to Williams' buckets at the other end and helped the Thunder build a 60-46 lead at halftime. Then the Thunder put the game on ice with a 37-point third quarter, with 10 of those points coming off Nuggets' 5 turnovers. Oklahoma City led by as many as 43 points in the fourth quarter. Denver was also 3 of 14 from beyond the arc in the third quarter and finished the game just 10 of 45 on three-pointers. "To have the start we wanted and then to have it all go sideways so quickly was tough," said Denver Nuggets interim coach David Adelman. "I thought we controlled the pace of the game early. It's easy to forget that now. Once they got back into it, they kept bringing new people in, and it did overwhelm us." A big part of the Thunder's success was thanks to Alex Caruso's defense. Despite a considerable size deficit, Caruso spent plenty of time on Nuggets star Nikola Jokic, who often found it difficult to find shots against Oklahoma City's top-ranked defense. Jokic scored 20 points on 5 of 9 shooting, while Caruso finished with a game-best plus 40 plus-minus rating. "The volume of it today was a result of how effective it was, but looking at it was a priority going into today," said Thunder head coach Mark Daniels regarding Caruso's efforts. "He did an unbelievable job individually." The Thunder scored 37 points off Denver's 23 turnovers, while giving the ball up just 10 times themselves. Nuggets forward Aaron Gordon, who suffered a hamstring injury late in Game 6 and was a game-time decision, played more than 24 minutes, finishing with 8 points and 11 rebounds. "It means a lot, specifically for the city," said Gilgeous-Alexander on advancing to the conference finals. "They've been so good all year. They've been behind us. Through good, through bad, no team in the league has a home court advantage like we do." So the NBA conference finals are set. In the East, it will be New York versus Indiana. The first two games will be Wednesday and Friday at New York, followed by May 25th and May 27th at Indiana, May 29th at New York if needed, May 31st at Indiana if needed, and June 2nd at New York if it goes 7 games. And in the West, it is Oklahoma City versus Minnesota. Their first two games will be Tuesday and Thursday at Oklahoma City, Saturday at Minnesota, along with May 26th at Minnesota. May 28th will be at Oklahoma City if needed, May 30th at Minnesota if needed, and June 1st at Oklahoma City if needed. And on a more local level, a report, Sun's narrow list to these coaching candidates. This is by Dana Scott of the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Suns are advancing to the second round of interviews to find their next head coach. On Sunday, NBA insider Chris Haynes reported the Suns have narrowed their search to 8 candidates. Those he cited include Suns' current assistant coach David Fizdale and assistants from 5 other teams, the Cleveland Cavaliers' Jordan Ott and Johnny Bryant, Dallas Mavericks' Sean Sweeney, Brooklyn Nets' Steve Hetzel, Oklahoma City Thunder's Dave Bliss, Minnesota Timberwolves' Micah Norrie, and New Orleans Pelicans' James Borrego. Miami Heat assistant coach Chris Quinn also advanced to the next round per NBA insider Jake Fisher for the Mark Stein Line report. The Republic's Dwayne Rankin reported last week the Suns conducted more than 15 first-round interviews. The Republic previously reported Fizdale, Quinn, Bryant, Norrie, and Borrego as possible candidates. New general manager Brian Gregory said during his introductory press conference on May 6 would be an extensive process for their next hire. Gregory also said they are looking for a coach who aligns with the ownership and front office for their vision of developing the team's new identity. Unbelievable basketball IQ, Gregory said about the type of coach Phoenix seeks. Tremendous communicator, shares our vision and what we understand needs to be done to be successful in basketball in this new NBA. During the Suns' end-of-season press conference, owner Matt Ishbia said he wants a coach who's a little bit grimy, a little bit grinder, and a little bit tough. Fizdale and Borrego have NBA head coaching experience. Fizdale was the Memphis Grizzlies and New York Knicks coach for one season each from 2017 through 19. Borrego coached the Charlotte Hornets from 2018 through 22. Both coaches have been on the Suns' and Pelicans' coaching staffs since 2023. One of Fizdale's other attributes is knowing how to deal with star players from his tenure as a Miami Heat assistant from 2008 through 16. He helped coach LeBron James, Hall of Famer Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh during Miami's back-to-back titles in 2012 and 13, as well as 4 straight NBA Finals appearances from 2010 through 14. Fizdale is known for his close relationships with the Suns' Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, and Bradley Beal. Ott and Hetzel have Michigan State connections to Ishbia and Gregory. Ishbia was a walk-on player for Michigan State's 2000 men's basketball national title team, and Gregory was on his coaching staff under Hall of Famer Tom Izzo. Ott was a video coordinator for the Spartans from 2008 through 13. Hetzel got his start as Izzo's student manager from 2003 through 5. Suns CEO Josh Bartlestein has familiarity with Norrie from their mutual days with the Detroit Pistons. Bartlestein rose through the ranks of the Pistons front office from 2015 through 23, the year he joined the Suns in his current role. Norrie was a Pistons assistant coach from 2018 through 21 before he joined Minnesota. The Suns' remaining candidates look like a departure from their previous plans to have a replacement possessing championship pedigree and previous head coaching roles. The last Suns' 2 coaches, Mike Budenholzer and Frank Vogel, met that criteria. Budenholzer won a title with Milwaukee over Phoenix in 2021 and Vogel with the Los Angeles Lakers in 2020. Both were fired after just one season leading the Suns, Vogel in 24 and Budenholzer just a day after his past regular season ended with Phoenix having a 36-46 record and missing the conference play-in. And in some WNBA action, Mercury's Sabalee and Thomas, key victory without Copper. This by Dana Scott of the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Mercury's post-Diana Taurasi and Brittany Griner era began with a bang in their 81-59 blowout victory at home over the Seattle Storm on May 17th. The regular season debut for their Big Three of Alyssa Thomas, Satu Sabali and Kalia Copper, together was delayed. Just hours before Phoenix's season-opening home game against the Seattle Storm, the Mercury announced that Copper underwent successful arthroscopic left knee surgery and will return in the next 4 to 6 weeks. Thomas and Sabali compensated for the Mercury's top returning scorer's absence by shining in their debuts for Phoenix. Sabali had a game-high 27 points, added 6 rebounds, 2 assists, 1 steal, and 1 block. Thomas produced 20 points, 7 rebounds, a team-high 5 assists, and 2 steals. Sabali started hot by hitting 6 of her first 9 attempts, including 3 from deep, and Thomas made 5 of her first 8. And now over to the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs. Panthers advance, crush Leafs in Game 7. Panthers 6, Maple Leafs 1. Brad Marchand and Eetu Luostarinen each had a goal and 2 assists for the visiting Florida Panthers, who advanced to the Eastern Conference Final of the Stanley Cup playoffs with a 6-1 win in Game 7 against the Toronto Maple Leafs on Sunday. Seth Jones had a goal and an assist, and Alexander Barkov had 2 assists for the Panthers, who reached the conference finals for a 3rd straight year. Sergei Bobrovsky made 19 saves. Max Domi scored, and Joseph Woll made 28 saves for the Maple Leafs, who hadn't won a Game 7 since 2004. Jones gave Florida a 1-0 lead at 3:15 of the second period, carrying the puck to the right circle on a 2-on-1 and firing a wrist shot that beat Woll on the far side over his right shoulder. Anton Lundell made it 2-0 at 7:18. Woll stopped a shot from Marchand, but the rebound bounced out in front to the low slot, and Lundell quickly put it past the goalie stick side. Jonah Gadovich increased it to 3-0 just over 2 minutes later. A.J. Greer retrieved his own rebound down low and fed it through the slot over to Gradovich for a quick wrister that beat Woll 5-hole at 9:39. Florida outshot Toronto 18-5 in the second period. Domi gave the Maple Leafs some life at 2:07 of the third period, spotting the Panthers on a line change. Bobby McMahon sent a diagonal cross-ice pass to Domi at the Florida blue line, and Domi took it to the left circle for a slap shot that cuffed the deficit to 3-1. The Panthers responded 47 seconds later, with Leo Stardinen redirecting Marchand's shot from the left Woll short side under Woll's stick to make it 4-1. Sam Reinhart extended the lead to 5-1 at 9:24. Barkov won the faceoff, and Reinhart was first to retrieve the loose puck above the left circle, slapping it through traffic over Woll's left shoulder. Toronto pulled Woll for the extra attacker with more than 4 minutes remaining, and Marchand put one into the empty net at 16:57 for the final 6-1. So their conference finals looked like this. In the East, it'll be Carolina versus Florida. Tuesday and Thursday at Carolina. Saturday and May 26th at Florida. May 28th at Carolina if needed. May 30th at Florida if needed. And June 1st at Carolina if needed. Then in the Western Conference final will be Dallas versus Edmonton. Wednesday and Friday at Dallas. Sunday and May 27th at Edmonton. May 29th at Dallas if needed, May 31st at Edmonton if needed, and June 2nd at Dallas if needed. Now over to some Major League Baseball, starting with the Arizona Diamondbacks. One step forward. Diamondbacks 1, Rockies nothing. D-backs bounce back, blank Rockies to win the series as Kelly and Marte lead the way. This by Nick Piacoro of the Arizona Republic. Merrill Kelly extended his string of dominant outings, firing 7 innings of one-hit ball to lead the Diamondbacks to a 1-0 win over the Colorado Rockies on Sunday afternoon, May 18th at Chase Field. The Diamondbacks' lone run came via a Ketel Marte solo shot in the bottom of the first inning. The win gave the Diamondbacks a series victory over the Colorado Rockies, allowing them to bounce back from a brutal loss the night before. They lost 14-12, the first loss in club history in a game in which they scored 12 runs or more. The only hit Kelly allowed came on a double by Jordan Beck to lead off the top of the sixth inning. Beck was caught in a rundown one batter later after he broke for third on a comebacker to the mound. Kelly retired the next two batters to end the inning. Over his past eight starts, Kelly has logged a 2.02 ERA across 49 innings, walking just eight while striking out 49. This was the second consecutive start in which he went seven innings, and the sixth time in his past eight starts he went at least six innings. For Marte, the blast was his sixth home run, all of them coming in the past 10 days. It was his fifth homer from the left side of the plate. Normally known for demolishing left-handed pitching, the switch-hitting Marte has started slowly this year from the right side. Right-hander Kevin Ginkel retired the side in order in the eighth inning, striking out a pair. Right-hander Shelby Miller had to work out of trouble in the ninth, but escaped with his fourth save. With one out, Kyle Farmer singled and Hunter Goodman doubled, prompting the D-backs to intentionally walk Ryan McMahon to load the bases. Miller then got Benton Doyle to pop out before Michael Toglia hit a screaming two-strike liner to shortstop Gerardo Perdomo to end the game. The Diamondbacks next play a series at the Los Angeles Dodgers. And in the Sunday roundup from Major League Baseball, Angels complete sweep of Dodgers. Travis Arnaud hit a go-ahead home run in the eighth inning, and the visiting Los Angeles Angels finished off a three-game sweep with a 6-4 victory over the Los Angeles Dodgers on Sunday. Zach Nato and Taylor Ward each hit home runs in the first inning, and left-hander Yuzi Kikuchi gave up one run on three hits with seven strikeouts over 5 2/3 innings, before leaving in the sixth inning with a right ankle injury. Right-hander Sean Anderson, who's 1-0, gave up one run in 2 2/3 innings of relief, striking out Shohei Ohtani to end the game. Will Smith hit a game-tying three-run home run in the seventh inning for the Dodgers, while Ohtani had three hits, with two coming against countryman Kikuchi. Next we have Brewers 5, Twins 2. Freddy Peralta allowed one run over five solid innings as the Milwaukee Brewers avoided a sweep with a victory over visiting Minnesota, snapping the Twins' 13-game winning streak. Peralta, who's 5-3, needed 90 pitches to navigate those innings, allowing one run, a solo homer, on three hits. He struck out five, walked two, and hit two batters. Trevor McGill finished with a perfect ninth for his sixth save in seven opportunities. Zebby Matthews, who's 0-1, called up from AAA St. Paul, allowed four runs on five hits in three innings in his season debut. Minnesota had not lost since a 6-1 defeat at Boston on May 2nd. Next, Mariners 6, Padres 1. Randy Arozarena homered to start a three-run rally, and Brian Wu sailed through seven innings as the visiting Seattle Mariners completed a three-game sweep of the San Diego Padres. Wu, who's 5-1, gave up just five hits and a run with no walks and five strikeouts, throwing 67 of his 87 pitches for strikes and permitting just one hit over his last 5 1/3 innings. He lowered his earned run average to 2.65. San Diego got off to a fast start when Fernando Tatis Jr. walloped his 12th homer to lead off the first, picking on a hanging sweeper and belting it in his estimated 398 feet to the seats in left center. We've already talked about the Diamondbacks 1, Rockies nothing, so we'll move over to the Giants 3, Athletics 2. Helia Ramos homered and later drove in the tie-breaking run with a single in the 8th, to lift the San Francisco Giants to a win against the visiting Athletics to complete a sweep of the three-game series. Tyler Ferguson, who's 0-2, started the eighth with the Athletics leading 2-1, but he surrendered a leadoff triple into the right center field gap by pinch hitter Lamonte Wade Jr. Patrick Bailey then grounded a pinch hit single up the middle with the infield in to tie the score. Bailey was sacrificed to second and came home on a ground ball single to left by Ramos for a 3-2 lead. The comeback spoiled another exceptional outing by A's left-hander Jeffrey Springs. He allowed one run and two hits over 6 2/3 innings, striking out 5 without a walk. Next, Braves 10, Red Sox 4. Marcell Ozuna hit a 2-run home run and had 3 RBIs to lead the visiting Atlanta Braves to a victory over the Boston Red Sox. The Braves had 16 hits and drew 7 walks in the win. Alex Verdugo and Austin Riley each collected 3 hits for Atlanta, which broke a 4-4 tie by scoring 3 runs in the 5th. The Braves threw 4 walks in the inning. Rafael Devers hit a grand slam for the Red Sox. It was his 9th home run of the season and his 2nd in as many games. Devers and David Hamilton each had 2 of Boston's 8 hits. Now we have Cubs 6, White Sox 2. Seiya Suzuki drove in 2 runs. Colin Rhea pitched 5 1/3 innings. And the Chicago Cubs completed a 3-game sweep of the visiting Chicago White Sox with the win. Rhea allowed 1 run on 4 hits with 2 walks and 3 strikeouts. After Drew Pomeranz, who's 0-1, got 2 outs in the 6th, Ryan Pressly and Brad Keller each pitched a scoreless inning before the White Sox scored a run in the 9th against Julian Merriweather. Miguel Vargas homered for the White Sox, who lost their 4th straight following a 3-game winning streak. Now Reds 3, Guardians 1. Will Benson remained red-hot when he homered twice to lead the host Cincinnati Reds to a win over the Cleveland Guardians and a sweep of the 3-game interleague series. Carlos Santana had an RBI single in the 7th for the Guardians, who have dropped 4 in a row after opening May with 8 wins in their first 12 games. Benson snapped a scoreless tie with a 2-run homer off Luis Ortiz, who's 2-5 in the 4th inning, before he added a solo shot off Hunter Gaddis in the 6th. Next we have Royals 2, Cardinals 1. Mikel Garcia delivered a tie-breaking RBI single in the 7th inning, while Michael Wacha and 4 Kansas City relievers helped strand 13 St. Louis runners as the Royals avoided being swept by the visiting Cardinals. Kansas City left 7 men on against St. Louis starter Matthew Librastor, who was brilliant in allowing 1 run, 6 hits, and 1 walk over 6 innings. However, the Royals wasted no time getting to Cardinals reliever Chris Raycroft, who was 1-3, in the 7th of a 1-1 contest. Next is Tigers 3, Blue Jays 2. Spencer Torkelson had a double, a single, and 3 RBIs, and the visiting Detroit Tigers defeated the Toronto Blue Jays. Torkelson's RBI single in the 7th broke a 2-2 tie. Dylan Dingler had 3 hits, and Riley Green added 2 for the Tigers in the rubber match of the 3-game series. We have Marlins 5, Rays 1. Otto Lopez belted a 3-run homer in just his 2nd at-bat off the injured list, and Cal Quantrill pitched an immaculate inning as the host Miami Marlins defeated the Tampa Bay Rays, and Quantrill, 3-4, earned the win, pitching his immaculate inning in the 4th, 9 pitches, 9 strikes, 3 strikeouts. He got 4 swinging strikes, 3 called strikes, and 2 foul balls. He threw 5 cutters, 2 fastballs, 1 sinker, and 1 curve. Rays starter Shane Bez, who's 3-3, lasted 6 innings, allowing 9 hits, 3 walks, and 5 runs. He struck out 2. Nationals 10, Orioles 4. C.J. Abrams hit the game's first pitch for the first of his 2 home runs, and the visiting Washington Nationals went on to beat the staggering Baltimore Orioles. Luis Garcia Jr., Dylan Cruz, and Josh Bell also homered for the Nationals, who've won 3 games in a row following a 1-8 stretch. They homered 5 times in a game for the first time since September 2023. Now we have Astros 4, Rangers 3. Isaac Paredes, 3-run 8th inning home run, was the difference as the Houston Astros roared from behind to beat the Texas Rangers in the finale of a 4-game series in Arlington, Texas. The Astros rallied to earn a split of the series between the Lone Star State rivals, coming alive just in time after struggling against Texas starter Jack Leiter, who had taken a no-hitter into the seventh. Paredes' homer off of reliever Robert Garcia made a winner out of the Astros. Starting pitcher Framber Valdez, who's 3-4, who allowed 3 runs off 6 hits over 7 innings in a pitcher's duel with Leiter. Valdez struck out 8, walked 1, and Brian Abreu pitched through a walk and a single in the 8th inning before Josh Hader retired the Rangers in order to earn his 11th save. Now, Phillies won, Pirates nothing. Mick Abel tied a franchise record with 9 strikeouts over 6 innings in his Major League debut as the host Philadelphia Phillies completed a 3-game sweep of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Abel, 1-0, a first-round pick in the 2020 MLB draft out of Jesuit High School in Portland, Oregon, scattered 5 hits and tied the team MLB debut strikeout mark set by Curt Simmons of Whiz Kids fame on September 28, 1947, against the New York Giants. Abel left after throwing 84 pitches, 62 for strikes. He didn't walk a batter and had just 3 3-ball counts. Now, Yankees 8, Mets 2. Cody Bellinger hit a grand slam to cap a 6-run 8th inning as the host New York Yankees pulled away for a victory over the New York Mets in the finale of the Subway Series. After Genesis Cabrera struck out Aaron Judge, Bellinger lifted a first-pitch 97-mile-per-hour fastball into the right field seats over the leaping try of Juan Soto. It was Bellinger's 9th career Grand Slam and first since July 15, 2023, for the Chicago Cubs as part of an inning where the Yankees capitalized on a throwing error by Mets first baseman Pete Alonso. Jason Dominguez started the Yankees' rally off Ryan Stenek, who's 1-4, by drawing a walk and took third on a double by Austin Wells before scoring the tie-breaking run on Alonso's error. Bellinger went 3-for-3 with a pair of walks and tied his career by driving in 6 runs. And to quickly run down the standings in Major League Baseball, starting with the American League East Division, the New York Yankees are on top at 27-19. 5 games back is both Boston and Toronto. Tampa Bay 6 games back, and Baltimore is 11.5 back. In the Central Division, Detroit is on top at 31-16. 5 games back is Minnesota. 5.5 games back is both Cleveland and Kansas City, while the Chicago White Sox are 17 games back. The West Division in the American League, Seattle is on top at 26-19. Both Houston and Texas are 2.5 games out. The Athletics are 5 games out, and the LA Angels are 6 games out. In the National League East, the New York Mets are on top at 29-18. The Philadelphia Phillies are 0.5 game behind them. Atlanta is 5 games back. Washington 8.5 back, and Miami 10 games out. In the Central Division, the Chicago Cubs are on top at 28-19, while St. Louis is 2 games back, Cincinnati 4.5, Milwaukee 6, and Pittsburgh 13 games out of first. And finally, in the National West Division, the LA Dodgers are on top at 29-18. The San Diego Padres are a game back, along with the San Francisco Giants. The Arizona Diamondbacks are 4 games out, and the Colorado Rockies are 20.5 games out of first. And in college baseball, starting over at the University of Arizona, they played a 3-game weekend series at Houston. They lost on Thursday 13-4, but won Friday 14-6, and won Saturday 8-1, which gives them the number 4 seed in the Big 12 tournament coming up this week. Meanwhile, over at ASU, they played at Oklahoma State over the weekend. They lost all 3 games on Thursday 6-2, Friday 9-6, and Saturday 7-4, which put them at the number 5 seed in the Big 12 tournament. So the Big 12 tournament schedule looks like this. On Wednesday, game 1 will be number 5 Arizona State versus number 12 BYU. Game 2, number 8 Cincinnati versus number 9 Texas Tech. Game 3 is number 7 Oklahoma State versus number 10 Baylor. And Game 4 will be number 6 Kansas State versus number 11 Houston. Then on Thursday, Game 5 will be number 4 Arizona versus either Arizona State or BYU. Game 6 will be number 1 seed West Virginia versus either Cincinnati or Texas Tech. Game 7 will be number 2 Kansas versus either Oklahoma State or Baylor. And Game 8 will be number 3 TCU versus either Kansas State or Houston. And in women's softball over at the University of Arizona, they had a busy weekend on Friday. They defeated Santa Clara in the first game of the Big 12 tournament, 13-5. Then on Saturday, they lost to Ole Miss, 10-8. Then they had to play in the loser's bracket on Saturday night. They won against Grand Canyon, 4-1. So they were back against Ole Miss Sunday afternoon, which they defeated Ole Miss, 10-1 in five innings, but lost in the night game, 7-3 to Ole Miss. So they are done for the season. And over at ASU women's softball, they played in the Los Angeles Regional, and they lost both of their first two games, first Friday against San Diego State, 3-2, and Saturday against UC Santa Barbara, 4-3 in 10 innings. So that is it for their season. And with that, we are coming up on our halfway point in this evening's sports today. Now over to some PGA golf news from the PGA Championship. Entitled Sunday Stroll, Scheffler claims third major with a 5-shot win. Scottie Scheffler was not at the top of his game, but survived a mid-round scare from John Rahm to win the PGA Championship by 5 strokes at Quail Hollow Club on Sunday. It wasn't as easy as many expected, but 28-year-old Scheffler collected his third major title with an even par 71 that was enough for the Olympic champion to pick up something much bigger than a gold medal, a huge Wanamaker trophy. "I'm just really proud of the way we fought this week," Scheffler said. "I was battling my swing the first couple of days. I'm looking forward to celebrating this one." He finished at 11 under 273, while fellow Americans Bryson DeChambeau at 70, Harris English at 65, and Davis Riley at 72, tied for second at 6-under. Venezuelan's Jonathan Vegas shot a 72. The tournament's 36-hole leader finished at 5-under, alongside Canadian Taylor Pendrith with a 68 and JT Paston with a 73. The large margin of victory disguised the fact that the final result was very much up in the air until Rahm self-destructed over the final 3 holes and plunged all the way down to tie for 4th at 4-under. Scheffler previously won the 2022 and 2024 Masters. The world number 1 started the day with a 3-shot lead, but several poor tee shots that he pulled on the front 9 eventually caught up with him as he ran up 3 bogeys on the outward half, along with 1 birdie. After Rahm, playing 2 pairings ahead, piled up 3 birdies in 4 holes around the turn, Scheffler arrived at the 10th tee tied for the lead. But Scheffler got his driving back on track with a good tee shot at the par 5 10th, eventually making an up-and-down birdie from a greenside bunker to regain the sole lead. He did not let it slip away again. A 7-foot birdie at the drivable par 4 14th, where he got up and down from a greenside bunker, extended his lead to 2 shots, and there would be no further drama, at least in the battle for victory. Scheffler has been so dominant since he burst onto the scene that only 3 years and 94 days have passed between his first PGA Tour victory and his 15th. Since 1950, only Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus took less time to accomplish the same feat, and only a few days at that. In his most recent start prior to the PGA Championship, Scheffler won the CJ Cup Byron Nelson Tournament by 8 strokes. Since 1970, only one other player has won consecutive PGA Tour appearances by at least 5 strokes, Woods, who did so twice. Scheffler is also the first player since Seve Ballesteros more than 4 decades ago to win his first 3 majors by at least 3 shots. Scheffler's performance here was a reminder, if any was needed, that though Rory McIlroy is golf's biggest current star, he has competition for the title of the game's best player. 5 weeks removed from completing the career Grand Slam, the Northern Irishman was out of sorts all week, finishing the tie for 47th at 3 over 287. It was a busy weekend for motorsports, and we'll start with NASCAR. Bell beats Logano in action-packed all-star race. That's from the Associated Press. Christopher Bell loves North Wilkesboro Speedway, and Joey Logano hates the promoter's caution. Those were the main takeaways from the top two finishers in an action-packed NASCAR All-Star race at the 5/8 mile oval in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. In a slam-bang affair that set a record for lead changes, Bell beat Logano by 0.829 seconds to earn his first All-Star race victory. Bell, who won three consecutive Cup Series races earlier this season, but had a previous best All-Star finish of 10th, delivered the third All-Star race win for Joe Gibbs Racing. "That right there is absolutely incredible," Bell said. "North Wilkesboro, best short track on the schedule." He also is a fan of Marcus Smith, the president and CEO of Speedway Motorsports that owns North Wilkesboro Speedway. In a new All-Star race wrinkle, Smith was allowed to choose when to throw a promoter's caution that would bunch the field for a late restart. Smith sent two-time Daytona 500 winner and Fox Sports personality Michael Waltrip to the flag stand to display the random yellow flag on lap 218, with Logano leading by about a half second over Bell. Logano, who was trying to win his second consecutive All-Star race, elected to stay on the track rather than pit during the caution, and the decision proved costly. Bell pitted for two tires, restarted in sixth, and needed only five laps to catch Logano. After a battle for first that lasted a dozen laps, Bell took the lead for good on lap 241 of 250. "I'm not happy right now," Logano said, who led a race-high 139 laps. "Just dang it, we had the fastest car. I'm trying to choose my words correctly on the caution situation. Obviously, I got bit by it, so I am the one frustrated." It was a stark turnaround for the defending Cup Series champion, who recently said he supported the promoter's caution because the All-Star race presents the opportunity to try things outside of the box, but he was questioning its validity after Sunday's race. "Yeah, I'm all about no gimmicks with the caution," Logano said. "I am all about that. Me and Marcus Smith aren't seeing eye to eye right now, okay? I've got to have a word with him." Ross Chastain finished third, followed by Alex Bowman and Chase Elliott. The promoter's caution was introduced to guarantee an exciting finish, but the All-Star race hardly needed much help this year. After lackluster showings in the first two outings, the All-Star race delivered much more action in its third year at North Wilkesboro Speedway. There were 18 lead changes, breaking the mark of 13 set in 2016 for the most in the event's 41-year history. Pole sitter Brad Keselowski and Logano traded the lead twice in the first 10 laps and often ran side-by-side for the lead. There were 6 leaders and 10 lead changes in the first half of the race, which topped the total number of leaders, 4, and lead changes, 5, in the past two All-Star races combined. After leading 62 laps, Keselowski's bid for his first All-Star race victory ended with a crash on lap 177. Now up next, the Cup Series will race May 25th at Charlotte Motor Speedway in the Coca-Cola 600, the longest race of the season. Christopher Bell won last year's race, which was shortened from 600 to 374 miles because of rain. Kyle Larson missed the 2024 race after arriving late because the Indianapolis 500 was delayed by rain. The Hendrick Motorsports star again will attempt to become the fifth driver to race in the Indy 500 and the Coca-Cola 600 on the same day. And speaking of the Indy 500 coming up this Sunday, rookie Schwartzman grabs the pole. The build-up to the Indianapolis 500 took an unexpected twist on Sunday when rookie Robert Schwartzman won the pole for the fabled race. In 5 IndyCar Series races, Schwartzman has finished no better than 18th. Yet the 25-year-old is the first rookie to qualify on the Indy 500 pole since Teo Fabi in 1983. That didn't matter Sunday when his 4-lap average of 232.790 miles per hour officially made his number 83 Chevrolet the fastest car in qualifying. Making the achievement even more surprising is that Schwartzman's team, Prema Racing, is new to the IndyCar scene as well. The Italian team has competed in the Formula 2 series in Europe before debuting in the North America circuit this year. Honestly, it feels like I'm dreaming. I just had it in my dreams when I was going how would it would feel to do such a good job in quali, said Schwartzman, a dual citizen of Russia and Israel. It's the Indy 500. It's the main race of the year. Honestly, it feels unbelievable. Takuma Sato of Japan, the 2017 and the 2020 Indianapolis 500 champion, landed in the second spot after Schwartzman outpaced his speed. Team Penske had a day to forget, with the cars of Joseph Newgarden and Will Power failing a technical inspection for illegal modifications on the rear attenuator. Newgarden is the two-time defending champion. Scott McLaughlin, meanwhile, had a major crash, slamming into the wall off turn two. Newgarden, Power, and McLaughlin will settle for 10th, 11th, and 12th positions in the starting grid. Marco Andretti, the grandson of racing icon Mario Andretti and the son of team owner Michael Andretti, was among three drivers to make the field via last chance qualifying. It will be his 20th consecutive start at the Indy 500. Marcus Armstrong and Rinas VK grabbed the other two remaining spots in the 33-car field, making Jacob Abel the one driver on the outside looking in. The 109th running of the Indianapolis 500 is scheduled again for Sunday, May 25th. And in a follow-up on some late-breaking news, Penske's Newgarden and Power dropped to the rear of the Indianapolis 500 grid. This from the Associated Press. Two-time defending champion Indianapolis 500 winner Joseph Newgarden and Team Penske teammate Will Power will have to start from the final two spots in the grid Sunday after their teams were penalized for violating the rules during qualifying weekend. IndyCar also announced Monday that the team strategists for the number 2 and number 12 have been suspended for the race. The cars will forfeit their qualification points and pit box selections, and each of the entries has been fined $100,000. It's the second time in just over a year that Team Penske's IndyCar program has been embroiled in controversy. The integrity of the Indianapolis 500 is paramount, IndyCar President Doug Bowles said. As we look to the remainder of the week and the race weekend, we will do everything we can to make it clear that this is not only the best racing on the planet, by racing where the best win under completely fair conditions. The trouble for Team Penske began before the Fast 12 shootout Sunday, when rival team owner Chip Ganassi was among a chorus of competitors who accused the team of cheating. They noticed unapproved changes had been made to the rear attenuator, which is a safety device designed to absorb and deduce the force of impacts, and the assumption was the modifications would have given the two Team Penske cars an aerodynamic advantage in their four-lap qualifying runs. Tim Sendrick, the president of Penske's IndyCar program, said Power passed inspection, but officials had flagged Newgarden's car, and he was told neither would pass inspection after making their runs, so the cars were pulled from the lineup altogether. Bowles initially said late Sunday that Newgarden and Power would join teammate Scott McLaughlin, who had crashed in practice on Sunday and was unable to make a qualifying run, in the fourth row for the race. But after the series gathered more facts and considered the case, the decision was made to put Newgarden in the 32nd spot and Power in the 33rd starting spot. McLaughlin will keep the 10th starting spot because his wrecked car was found to have used a legal attenuator. And in NHRA Pro Series drag racing, Tony Stewart, Jack Beckman, and Gage Herrera collect wins at Route 66 Raceway. Racing legend Tony Stewart moved into the NHRA Top Fuel points lead for the first time with his second win in three races on Sunday at Route 66 Raceway, defeating Justin Ashley in the final round of the 25th annual Gerber Collision and Glass Route 66 NHRA Nationals presented by Peak. Jack Beckman in Funny Car and Gage Herrera in Pro Stock Motorcycle also won the sixth of 20 races during the 2025 NHRA Mission Foods Drag Racing Series season. Stewart went 3.777 seconds at 329.10 mile per hour in his Renai Dragster to hold off Ashley and earn his second Top Fuel win, just more than a month after he won for the first time in his Top Fuel career in Las Vegas. It's the fourth straight final round for Stewart and his standout team, as he also moved 3 points ahead of Sean Langdon, who fell in the second round, to take the Top Fuel points lead for the first time. Stewart, who made a career-best run of 3.679 in qualifying, defeated Terry Totten, Sean Reed, and Steve Harns to reach the championship round. Ashley left first with a stout .042 reaction time, but Stewart was right there with a .048, quickly running him down and cruising to another impressive victory, and was shaping up to be a special season for the former NASCAR and Indy Car champion. Funny Car's Jack Beckman needed his own impressive performance on the starting line, and he delivered, winning on a hole shot in the final round against John Force Racing teammate and reigning world champion Austin Prock with a run of 3.93 seconds at 325.77 miles per hour in his 12,000 horsepower peak Chevrolet. Prock went a quicker 3.933 at 329 miles per hour and had his own solid reaction time, but Beckman went .049, which made the difference at the finish line as he earned his second victory this season and 37th in his professional career. Since returning to racing and taking over driving duties for the legendary John Force late last year, Beckman has 4 wins in 14 races, moving to second in points on Sunday with the memorable victory at the sponsor's race. The veteran and former world champion got past Dave Richards, Chad Green, and Cruz Pedregon to set up the all-JFR final round and ensured a 4th JFR win in the first 6 races of 2025, as both Beckman and Prock continue to roll at an impressive pace. On Sunday, though, it was Beckman who got back on track in a major way after first-round losses at the previous 2 events. In Pro Stock Motorcycle, Gage Herrera still hasn't tasted defeat at Route 66 Raceway, knocking off rival Matt Smith in the finals with a run of 6.777 at 198.9 miles per hour on his RevZilla Mission Foods Vanson Hines Suzuki. It's the third straight Chicago victory for the back-to-back world champion, and Herrera was stellar when it counted in the championship round against Smith. He laid down a .005 reaction time, keeping Smith at bay and winning for the second time this season and the 23rd time in his career. He's on track for another special season, too, it appears, qualifying number 1 at the first 3 races, winning 2 of the first 3 races, and also taking the Mission Too Fast, Too Tasty challenge on Saturday to sweep the weekend in Chicago. On Sunday, he knocked off John Hall and Chris Bostic to reach the final before dispatching of Smith and leaving Chicago with the Pro Stock Motorcycle points lead. Their next race will be May 30th through June 1st, the NHRA New England Nationals at New England Dragway in Epping, New Hampshire. And in some horse racing news from the Preakness, Journalism rallies to win the Preakness. Journalism won the 150th running of the Preakness Stakes on Saturday at Baltimore's Pimlico Racecourse in stunning fashion, catching Longshot Gosger just before the wire after recovering from a bump down the stretch. Ridden by Umberto Rispoli, Journalism broke well from the second gate and settled off the pace that was set by Clever Again. The 3-year-old colt ran a similar race as he did in the Kentucky Derby 2 weeks ago, coming from back in the pack to contend down the stretch. This time, Journalism and Rispoli, who finished second in Louisville, had enough in the tank to take the lead in the final strides. Before that, though, Journalism was 6th coming out of the final turn and appeared to be pinned along the rail. Rispoli placed him between goal-oriented and Clever Again, and the 3 horses bumped, with Gosger several lengths ahead. The colt, sired by Curlin, recovered in time to edge Gosger, who at 15-1 was the third longest shot in the field of nine at the wire. Coming out of the turn, Rispoli and Flavian Pratt, the jockey on goal-oriented, made contact with each other as Rispoli urged journalism to make his move. Stewards at Pimlico reviewed the race, but did not take journalism down as the winner, giving him five victories in his last six starts. Speaking to reporters, Rispoli said he first thought about taking his horse wide coming out of the final turn. Then he remembered some advice he received from Hall of Fame jockey Jerry Bailey. "A little gap was open, and I say, it's now or never," said Rispoli, who became the first Italian jockey to win a Triple Crown race. "It's horse racing. I think it's a nice battle for the sport. Everybody came out safe." The win gives trainer Michael McCarthy his second Preakness victory and second in a Triple Crown race. He won with Rambauer 4 years ago. Going off at even odds, journalism paid $4 to win, $2.80 to place, and $2.40 to show. Gosger, trained by Brendan Walsh, had and ridden by Louis Saez, paid $9 and $5.40. Sandman paid $3.60. "You're disappointed not to win, but you cannot be disappointed in the horse," Walsh told FanDuel TV moments after the race. "He made a big step up today, and I think he can still improve this horse off of this." The Triple Crown races conclude on June 7th with the Belmont Stakes, held this year at Saratoga Racecourse in Saratoga Springs, New York. And in a side article on the Triple Crown horse racing, "Great Preakness exposes horse racing's failures." In a few weeks, they're going to start tearing down what's left of the old Pimlico, a historic racetrack that has been rotting in the middle of Baltimore for decades. Revived year after year, only for one reason. When you have the middle jewel of horse racing's Triple Crown, you do whatever you can not to lose it. As journalism won Saturday's 150th edition of the Preakness, surviving one of the most rough and tumble stretch runs you'll ever see and coming back from what seemed like an impossible position with an eighth of a mile to go, you can understand why the state of Maryland is about to invest $400 million to give the place the facelift it deserves. Yes, even in a fractured sport that struggles to gain mainstream interest outside of 5 weeks every year, the Preakness still matters, and the Maryland lawmakers have put huge stakes on the table to keep it. But that investment isn't going to pay off unless horse racing gets its act together. As thrilling as Saturday's race was, and as great of a horse as journalism appears to be, did anyone but the sport's dwindling diehards care? The answer, of course, is not really. The moment Kentucky Derby winner Sovereignty was withdrawn from consideration for the Preakness, the race was essentially rendered meaningless in the greater sports landscape. And it didn't have to be that way. In the old days, a rematch between Sovereignty and journalism, who ran eyeball to eyeball in the Derby until the former pulled ahead in the stretch, would have been worth at least a few headlines over the last couple of weeks. Instead, Sovereignty's connections decided that coming back just 2 weeks after the Derby, which is almost unheard of at any level of horse racing these days, was not a good fit for their horse. We'll see him again in 3 weeks at Belmont, rested and ready. With the Preakness field coming up pretty weak, journalism trainer Michael McCarthy threw his hat in the ring and got rewarded with a victory in a $2 million race. But given the two hard races he already has under his belt, the odds of bringing journalism to New York for a rematch are low. Maybe they'll meet again in late August at the Travers Stakes, known in racing as the Midsummer Derby, or the season-ending Breeders' Cup Classic. It's possible the Derby will end up being their only meeting. And given the way this Triple Crown has played out through two races, we'll always wonder, what if? What a blown opportunity for a sport that could use the kind of rivalry we used to see all the time, whether it was Affirmed and Adar, or Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, the best raced against the best in the biggest races over and over again. The horses had actual fan bases who showed up at the track. The owners and trainers often didn't like each other. And it was awesome for horse racing, for the broadcasters, for the bettors, and for the casual fans who just wanted to tune in for some human and equine drama. Can it ever get back to that? Not the way the Triple Crown is structured these days. The problem with changing anything about the Triple Crown is that Churchill Downs, Pimlico, and the New York Racing Association all operate as separate entities. If you want to move the Preakness 2 weeks later, well, you need to first get Belmont to move their race later in the calendar year, too. That's not so easy when everyone has their own piece of real estate. But the most powerful people in horse racing need to understand one thing. It is the benefit of everyone if the best horses run in all three legs of the Triple Crown, and it's essentially crucial to Maryland, which is about to start this massive construction project on the premise that the Preakness is going to attract the Derby winner every year, barring injury. Unless that happens, Maryland has wasted its time and money. It's not so good for Belmont's piece of the pie either, if there's almost never going to be a chance for a Triple Crown winner, or at least a sustained rivalry, on its biggest day. As Pimlico closes its doors and moves the Preakness about 15 miles south to Laurel Park for a couple of years, all the relevant entities need to get in room and decide what's best for the future and for horse racing. Because even a great race and a great horse doesn't do much to keep your sport relevant when there's no overarching story to tell. That's just basic journalism. And that's going to wrap up tonight's edition of Sports Today for Tuesday, May 20th, 2025. I'm Russ Warner, tonight's host of Sports Today and a volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a good evening and stay tuned for more. Don't forget, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcast. Also, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.